Unlike other state-owned oil giants like Saudi Arabia's Saudi Aramco or Norway's Equinor, Brazil's Petrobras was founded without meaningful oil reserves. Bit strange, isn't it? But for decades, Brazilians believed that their country had oil, and they persisted in that belief despite words and data saying otherwise. And their faith was rewarded. Turns out there was oil in Brazil, it just wasn't on land. In this video, how Brazil learned to drill its deep water oil. While there are records of people drilling for oil in Brazil since the late 1800s, these efforts were small and scattershot. Fossil fuel exploration in Brazil more focused on finding coal for the national steel effort. Didn't find any, by the way. This is in contrast to developments in the rest of South America, where international oil companies like Standard Oil and Royal Dutch Shell struck major fields in Venezuela and Colombia. For decades, the Brazilian economy instead heavily depended on the production and export of coffee. In the 1920s, Brazil dominated the world coffee market with 75% share. This centralized power, with the coffee oligarchs primarily living in the state of Sao Paulo. And as coffee prices doubled leading up to 1925, life was good, at least for them. But then, in the second half of the 1920s, production far exceeded demand. And after the Wall Street crash of 1929, coffee prices were something like 10% of what they were in earlier days. The economic crisis that followed eroded the legitimacy of Brazil's rural coffee oligarchs. In 1930, a coalition of military generals and urban elites launched a revolution that brought Brazilian President Getúlio Vargas to power. Vargas's rule shifted Brazil's economy towards industrialization, and oil became a part of this push. In 1934, he announced a new quote-unquote mining code that nationalized all the oil beneath the ground. To fend off foreign producers, the government set up the National Department of Mineral Production, or DNPM, to find oil in the country. The DNPM hired foreign oil experts to help, and they reported nothing of significance, but people were unfazed. Brazil was so massive, how can it not have oil? Government efforts soon received public criticism from an unexpected source. Monteiro Lobato was one of Brazil's most famous writers. About half of his work consisted of children's fantasy books, but he also dabbled in literary criticism and journalism. I might imagine that he was like the Neal Stephenson of his day, but I reckon a bit more varied. Lobato was an economic nationalist who believed that Brazil's oil should belong to Brazilians. In the late 1920s, he traveled to the United States and saw how the country's people leveraged its massive natural resources for their own benefit, particularly their oil. Believing that Brazil had to have oil somewhere within its massive borders and not wanting to leave it to foreign oil companies, he got involved in oil exploration. His time and growing frustration with these ventures eventually colored his writing. In 1936, Lobato wrote a series of fictional but inspired by reality books criticizing the DNPM for being in cahoots with hidden interests by suppressing national oil exploration. And by hidden interests, he meant the international oil companies or the octopus, Standard Oil. He summed it up with a catchy slogan. The DNPM was not founded to find oil, but to prevent anybody finding it. Lobato organized a national campaign to pressure the government, and in response, the government set up the National Petroleum Council, or CNP, endowed with greater control over oil exploration. It was led by General Horta Barbosa, a staunch economic nationalist. They drilled in the state of Bahia, and in 1939, they found Brazil's first commercial-grade oil well, named Candias 1, in the district of Lobato. By the way, the district's naming was a funny coincidence. It's been called that since the 1600s. World War II sparked a massive industrialization drive in Brazil, and this presented an issue. Yes, the Bahia oil fields were commercial, but by the end of the war, they produced at most 200 barrels a day. The country had to import oil to fulfill its booming demand, mostly from Venezuela. Those first discoveries in Bahia sparked an initial wave of exploration, but the CNP banned any private companies from prospecting in the area, which again caused frustration to build up. President Vargas ruled Brazil with a tight grip. During World War II, however, he fought on the side of the Allies, adopting democratic language in doing so. People soon identified the hypocrisy of fighting for freedom abroad, but running a dictatorship at home. Vargas tried to assuage them with a few liberalizing moves, but in October 1945, a coterie of high military officials, believing Vargas to be trying to seize permanent power, ousted him in a bloodless military coup. His removal opened the door to conservative pragmatists who advocated that Brazil allow foreigners like Standard Oil or Anglo-Mexican Petroleum to invest in the oil business. It would accelerate technology development and flag the country's friendliness to foreign investors. The nationalists rejected this, calling the conservatives sellouts and campaigning vigorously with the now famous slogan, "The oil is ours." This sparked an ideological war over the Conco oil problem. Even after his ouster, Vargas continued to exercise influence in Brazil. In 1950, he brilliantly executed a populist campaign that positioned him as the father of the poor, which returned him to the presidency. To mollify both factions, Vargas decided to take a middle way. In October 1953, he signed into law an act to create a state-owned company called Petrobras and gave it a federal monopoly over all oil development activities. Petrobras received $2 million in startup capital and inherited assets of $165 million, including the Bahia wells, which produced about 2,400 to 2,700 barrels of oil per day. But with an estimated total recoverable reserves of just 15 million barrels, those fields were a pittance. Petrobras needed more. In 1954, an American oil geologist named Walter K. Link was given an offer he could not refuse. Blunt, but well-respected, Link prospected for oil in Indonesia, Venezuela, and New Guinea for 20-plus years. In 1954, he left semi-retirement as chief geologist for Standard Oil of New Jersey to build Petrobras' exploration program. The Brazilians gave him an annual salary of $100,000, or about $1.2 million today, tax-free. This must be like the Saudis paying Phil Mickelson $200 million to golf in their league. Link put together 15 teams of 200-plus geologists to study rock formations, collect samples, survey subsurface structures, and drill exploratory wells. These were originally staffed by foreigners, but would over time be replaced by native Brazilians. Strict admission tests were set up to choose such Brazilian applicants on merit. Graduate-level courses were established to train them, taught by experts from the United States or Europe. Meanwhile, Petrobras started building up the infrastructure downstream of the oil. They took on the country's first oil refinery, Mataripe, in Bahia, and expanded its capacity. And they bought a fleet of 22 oil tankers to transport oil abroad. In 1958, with Brazil importing 150 to 180,000 net barrels a day at a cost of $270 million a year in foreign exchange, Petrobras President Colonel January Nunez publicly set a goal of doubling the amount of oil pumped from the current 53,000 to 110,000 in 1961. At the same time, Petrobras announced it would invest $900 million into more drilling and infrastructure. This was funded with debt and generous government gifts, including tariff exemptions, tax relief on equipment, and a scheme that let the company keep 80% of precious foreign exchange it made from selling Brazilian oil. Over 6 years, Link's teams drilled the various sedimentary basins within Brazil's borders, from the Amazon River to the São Francisco estuary. You might say he was taking a deep breath of the wild. They spent over $200 million and drilled 200-plus wells. They found over 100 oil-producing wells, but no major field. And all the commercially viable wells were still in the Bahia state. At the end of his 6-year contract, a disheartened Link delivered a report of his team's work to Petrobras' board of directors. Initially confidential, the report quickly leaked to the public. In it, Link and a team of 14 geologists, 6 of whom were Brazilian, rated Brazil's 12 onshore sedimentary basins. None of the basins were given an A rating. The best rating was a B+, awarded to the Recôncavo Basin in Bahia. Link noted that 95% of Brazil's onshore sedimentary basins were covered with lava beds thousands of feet thick. Oil has never been found in such structures, perhaps because the heat burns off any organic material or does not properly trap oil. And even if these remote basins had oil, the logistics of pumping in the Amazon seemed utterly insurmountable. He advised Brazilians to stop pouring money down the drain, saying, quote, "There is no geological justification for spending another $20 million in these basins in 1961. The hope that oil might be accidentally discovered is very small and cannot be scientifically or technically justified." When Link first took the job, the world thought Brazil's lands were awash in oil, so the public did not take the report well. Iraci Magalhães, Petrobras' first president and the person who hired Link, said, "Why wouldn't God have conceded this present to us?" Communist Brazilians called Link a tool of private capital. The Nationalists claimed that he was simultaneously holding a second job at Standard Oil, steering Petrobras to the quote-unquote wrong places. Link was obviously insulted, but said, "I didn't quit. I wasn't fired. My contract was finished, and it was finished at the date I specified. I'm not mad at the Brazilians, and I don't think they're mad at me. The Brazilians are nice people. I like them very much. We enjoyed our stay. We even adopted 2 Brazilian children, 10 and 12 years old." Link's work wasn't all for naught. By 1961, Petrobras produced an average of 85,000 barrels of oil per day. For one day, they pushed to 100,000, a titanic improvement over the 2,400 or so daily barrels the wells produced in 1954. However, the country had refining capacity of 290,000 barrels a day, and Brazilians were consuming 300,000 barrels a day at a cost of $250 to $300 million a year. Link recommended that Petrobras focus on refining activities and prospect for oil abroad, as well as to go, quote, "to the sea," end quote. Petrobras was under a great deal of pressure politically. Opposing politicians constantly decried the company's protected status. 40% of its revenues and profits came from earmarks and protections. No matter Walter Link's earnestness in delivering the results, the report came at a bad time. In March 1961, Petrobras hired a pair of Brazilian scientists, geologist Pedro de Moura, who had worked on that first well back on the Candias, and geophysicist Décio Severo Odon, to give a second opinion on the Link report. The two offered a more optimistic view of Brazil's oil potential, noting that Link's teams did not drill enough wells to make such a sweeping judgment. They advocated to continue investigating certain basins like the Amazon, Sergipe, and offshore basins. So Petrobras kept on drilling those basins, including the Sergipe. In mid-1961, one of those wells, named Rosario do Catete, showed signs of live oil, meaning oil with some of its original components. It hinted that basin did indeed have oil. Petrobras commissioned a seismic survey that showed an upward fold in the rock layers capable of trapping oil. In August 1963, they drilled an exploratory well and discovered Brazil's largest onshore oil field, Carmópolis, with recoverable reserves of 1 billion barrels. Link's teams drilled there before and had simply been unlucky in not finding this particular field. Moura and Odon's gutsy but correct call showed Brazilians that their people were ready to helm a national champion. Even so, Carmópolis was nowhere near big enough to make the country self-reliant in terms of oil. 80% of Brazil's demand still had to be met with imports from the foreign oil giants, draining foreign exchange and engendering nationalist sentiment. So, in the early 1960s, the nationalists pushed to make Petrobras the sole company in the energy sector. Petrobras was given an oil import monopoly. Key private refineries were expropriated and merged into Petrobras, and Petrobras was allowed to distribute oil products, setting up retail outlets. Then, in April 1964, another coup overthrew the leftist President Goulart and installed a military dictatorship. This meant big changes for Petrobras. The coup curbed the influence of the nationalists. The new government maintained their rhetoric, but adopted a more pragmatic approach. The expropriated private refineries were returned, and the company started exploring foreign partnerships. New leadership also cracked down on what had been a growing trend of labor union activities, purging labor leaders and replacing them with less political technocrats. The company was then integrated as a critical pillar into a larger industrialization strategy. In 1968, or 1969, General Ernesto Geisel became the Petrobras chairman. Guaranteed political air cover to make bold moves, he set the company's mission to be to, quote, guarantee the domestic supply of oil products, end quote. This, in practice, translated to three things. One, it meant allowing for oil exploration abroad, and they founded an international subsidiary named Braspetro to do this. Two, it meant expanding downstream refining capacity and distribution of oil products to gain scale and reduce costs for consumers. Petrobras aggressively expanded its retail outlets, in some cases evicting foreign-owned outlets from good locations to do so. They got into petrochemicals and fertilizers as well. Third and finally, it means that Petrobras had to start drilling offshore in the coastal plains and the continental shelf where people guessed that Brazil's oil would be. Geisel's thinking was that if Petrobras did not find oil offshore, the first two served as a hedge. His success in following through on this strategy and leading Brazil's largest company contributed to his elevation to the presidency in 1974. The Carmópolis field decisively concluded that the Sergipe Basin produced oil and hinted at more offshore. Located on an onshore continental margin formed after the breakup of the supercontinent Gondwana, the basin had all the right geological conditions for generating, migrating, and trapping oil. At the same time, news had spread of oil discoveries in other basins at the world's continental margins. Petrobras leadership thus deduced that Brazil's other continental margins, located underwater, might harbor similar conditions. Drilling offshore, however, would be technically challenging. Fortunately, the rest of the world was working on the same issues. New breakthroughs in offshore oil drilling were being pioneered in the coasts off Texas and Mexico, as well as the North Sea near Norway and Britain. Three fundamental new technologies were key to making offshore drilling economically viable. First, floating drilling platforms that allow companies to go and reach deep water regions further offshore. Subsea well completions that allow companies to install well equipment on the ocean floor, protecting them from damage due to rough surface conditions. And finally, new digital seismic computer tools for surveying, processing, and interpreting seismic data, allowing companies to have the confidence that the oil will be there when they start drilling. In 1966, Petrobras commissioned its first domestic floating offshore drilling platform, Petrobras 1, or P1, built at the cost of $30 million. 100% built in Brazil, but incorporating foreign technology. In 1968, thanks to a 37% increase in the exploration budget, the company opened their own digital surveying center, equipped with a powerful IBM 360 mainframe computer to process data. An American computer, not a Brazilian one. These led to Brazil's first offshore oil well success. Petrobras had contracted a jack-up offshore drilling vessel called the Vinagaroon from the Zabata Offshore Company to start drilling offshore. The first subsea well was drilled in 50-meter deep waters in a region called Espirito Santos, so it was called ESS-01. ESS-01 came up dry, but showed signs of salt. salt can seal in oil, so the exploration teams got excited, saying, "Basin with salt is basin with oil." However, the Vinegaroon was not prepared to drill the salt, so Petrobras exploration head geologist Carlos W. M. Campos ordered the contracted jackup rig over to Sergipe's offshore regions. There, in August 1968, it drilled hole SES-1, discovering what is now known as the Guacema field, Brazil's first commercial offshore oil field. Early on, it produced about 2,000 barrels of high-quality oil each day. Completed in July 1968, the floating platform Petrobras 1 was ordered to the field to start drilling. It took 25 days for the platform to travel from Rio de Janeiro, and historical accounts detail how engineers worried it might never get there. But it got there, and in 1969, they successfully drilled 5 holes, the first year of what turned out to be 26 years of service. I think now it's a hotel, which is pretty cool. All of this came as the global oil market moved from a glut to a shortage and then a crisis. The first oil crisis in 1973 caused oil prices to skyrocket from $2 a barrel to $14. Since Brazil was then still importing 70 to 80% of its oil, its import bill spiked from $1 billion in 1972 to $4.9 billion in 1974. In Brazil, oil is not just a nice to have, it is essential to its whole economy. Brazil's limited waterways meant that people had to drive to get around, and the country's high poverty levels make its people extremely sensitive to inflation. So the oil crisis put unprecedented pressure on Petrobras to replace imports with domestic supply. The company borrowed heavily to expand its offshore oil exploration efforts with more marine data and compute. One of the coastal basins reviewed was the Campos Basin, southeast of Rio de Janeiro. It had been drilled very early in 1959, but that well was completely dry. Moreover, it showed an unpromising geology. The well drilled 1,940 meters of sedimentary rocks. These rocks were thought to be from the continent, as in from rivers and lakes, and this was not considered as good as marine sedimentary rocks. Below that layer was about 625 meters of volcanic basalt. Basalt is hard and impermeable and not easy to drill through. Drillers at the time did not see any particular reason for the hassle and so left it at that. But that was 1959. Things have changed. In 1971, Petrobras returned to the Campos as part of its overall strategy of exploring the offshore coastal basins. These surveys identified some promising structures, but frustratingly, the first few wells came up dry. Then in 1973, Petrobras drilled well RJS-7 in the Campos. At 3,200 meters, the drill hit a thick section of limestone, an unfavorable rock. Despite this discouraging sign, the story goes that the Petrobras head of exploration, CWN Campos, ordered the team to keep on drilling based on his experience and instincts. At 3,401 meters, the rock suddenly changed, and the well revealed a significant amount of oil. The actual RJS-7 well didn't turn out to be a commercial well due to a lack of flow, but it was a majorly heartening sign. Later that year, the drill ship Petrobras 2 started drilling in waters 62 miles from the shore and 120 meters deep, unprecedented for the time. A first well, RJS-9, suffered mechanical issues at depths of 3,000 meters. A second, RJS-9A, discovered the field we now call Garupa, the first of many in the Campos Basin. Along with the Santos and Espirito Santo basins, these three basins are called the Three Sisters of Brazil's oil industry. The oil discovery highlighted a new problem. Before 1968, Petrobras had never extracted oil from an offshore field before. In fact, you might credibly argue that they were then more of a refining and oil products company, importing oil and refining it into gasoline and fertilizers for Brazilian consumers. How can such a company turn itself into a highly technical deep water specialist? To pressure the company to gain this expertise and replace imported oil, President Geisel publicly demanded in 1975 that Petrobras sign risk service deals with the foreign oil giants, where the foreigners are allotted plots to prospect for oil. The foreigners did not get a lot out of it eventually, complaining that they got the riskier and lower quality plots to prospect, but the threat of facing competition lingered over Petrobras. At the same time, Petrobras' hopes of securing oil abroad suffers a major setback. In 1975, Petrobras' international arm, Braspetro, hits a magnificent supergiant oil field called Majnun. The name literally means crazy, which amuses me. Brazil's initial 1972 contract entitled Petrobras to 20% of the oil it discovered at a discount. But then, the Iraqi government nationalizes the whole oil industry and changes the contract. And then comes the Iran-Iraq War. Iran occupies the Majnun area, making further development impossible. The door to foreign sources of cheap oil is firmly closed. So in the end, Petrobras had no choice but to develop their own offshore capacity, and as it so often does, it led to new innovations. Usually it takes about 4 to 6 years to build a fixed oil platform and start extracting oil from an offshore oil field, like how it is done in the Gulf. But Brazil did not have that kind of time or capital. So Petrobras adopted a risky concept known as the Early Production System, or SPA, pioneered by an American oil startup called Hamilton Brothers for the Argyll field in the North Sea. In this, they bring a semi-submersible platform and then tie it to subsea wells. The methodology allowed Petrobras to start producing 10,000 barrels a day from a field called the Anchova field just 2 years after its discovery. And when a production tower at the aforementioned Gurupa field collapsed in September 1980, Petrobras floated over a processing ship called the Pipi Moraes to connect to the subsea wells and extract oil while a longer-lasting system can be found. As we move into the 1980s, things start to get more dire. The second oil crisis in 1978 hits Brazil particularly hard. Annual inflation rises to 72% each year. Worse yet, the country had, in prior years, borrowed billions of dollars to fund economic development, that piled up over $50 billion of external debt. When the U.S. Federal Reserve raised interest rates in the late 1970s to start fighting inflation, capital started to flow out of Brazil. The currency started to weaken, making oil imports more expensive. In 1980, just 17% of the country's oil demand can be satisfied with domestic supply. Desperate to wean off imports, Brazil starts developing hydropower and investigating alternative fuels made of sugarcane and melon shells. To blunt the effect on consumers, the country imposes price controls on oil and oil products, but someone has to pay for that. So Petrobras squirreled away differences in the external and internal prices of oil into a deficit oil account, which would only grow throughout the 1980s. Amidst this desperate need for oil, two major developments finally helped Petrobras tap its bounty of offshore oil. One in discovery, the other in recovery. In the 1970s, Petrobras contracted with two members of the Texas Bureau of Economic Geology, trying to find a better way to know where the oil is before starting to drill for them. These guys introduced some work pioneered by Exxon and other oil majors that helped them model Brazil's underwater basins at its continental margins, and those models pointed to a geological structure called turbidite systems. Turbidites are structures left behind by massive underwater avalanches along the continental shelf. Such avalanches can be triggered by storms or earthquakes or sediments from rivers. I mentioned these briefly in a prior video about underwater cables. Turbidity currents caused by whatever are common cutters of these poor cables. Anyway, these avalanches transport massive amounts of sediment that end up settling on the ocean floor in thick and wide sediment deposits that are good at sealing in and trapping hydrocarbons. Turbidites unlocked major discoveries in the Gulf, and now Brazil wanted to use this weird little trick to strike oil for themselves. And in the late 1970s, their maps pointed to a turbidite body far offshore, implying a massive oil field below it. The issue, however, was that the area was located 2,500 to 3,000 meters underground in waters 400 to 1,000 meters deep. It seemed simply too difficult to reach. But then Petrobras caught wind of a new type of drill ship in the industry. Dynamic positioning systems use satellite and computer-controlled thrusters and propellers to allow ships and drilling rigs to maintain a fixed position relative to a point on the seafloor. They replaced anchors, which are not practical in such deep waters. Shell pioneered the idea in the 1960s with the Eureka drill ship and kept working on it throughout the 1970s to continually push the limits in water depth barriers. Then, in October 1983, Shell's dynamically positioned drillship, the Discoverer Seven Seas, made a major discovery in the Gulf at about 400 meters depth. And earlier that same year, it drilled a dry well that went 2,000 meters deep underwater. At the same time, the recession and oil glut of the 1980s made these technologically advanced dynamically positioned ships more available to Petrobras. In late 1984, they rented the French-owned Pelerin and drilled well RJS-219A at 850 meters of water, discovering the giant field Marlin. Recognizing the challenges of getting to that oil, Petrobras launched a special research program in 1986. The field was developed in careful phases and subphases, with learnings from each phase rolled into the next. First, a pre-pilot, where in March 1991, a converted semi-submersible floating production unit, or FPU, called the Petrobras 13, produced first oil from two drilled wells. Then a pilot, a year later, where a different semi-submersible platform, FPU, called the P-20, produced from 10 wells in 1992. Then, five modules across two phases starting in 1994. Phase 1 had modules 1 and 2, which brought two semi-submersible FPUs and one ship-like FPU to the field. The reservoir's response was so good, they added one more FPU in this phase, P-33, and made P-20 stay from the pilot permanent. Phase 2 had modules 3, 4, 5, where they added two more ship-like FPUs and a semi-submersible FPU. By 2000, a total of 8 FPUs had been installed at the field. By 2016, the field supported 12 FPUs pulling up oil from the depths. From there, and going into the 1990s, Petrobras has gone deeper and deeper into the Campos Basin. And in the process, turned the Brazilian Ocean into the major oil province that the country's oil pioneers had long dreamt of. Before we conclude, I want to thank fan Eric A. from Brazil for writing in and suggesting this topic. Petrobras has gone on to discover a multitude of deep water oil fields. This includes some of the biggest discoveries in the Western Hemisphere in the past 30 years. These pre-salt fields are on hard mode. They are regularly found under some 2,000 meters of water and 3,000 to 4,000 meters of sediment, unfathomably deep, yet now being produced. Today, virtually all of Petrobras' 11.4 billion barrels of oil equivalent reserves are in these immensely challenging offshore pre-salt fields. In 2023, per IEA statistics, Brazil, once so dependent on oil from abroad, produced an oil surplus. Brazil is now the most prolific oil-producing country in Latin America. An incredible turnaround based on technology, industrial policy, and faith in what God had granted to the country. All right, everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.